move on to the next part of the evening, which is a conversation between Noel Violet and Drew Shaw. Dr. Drew Shaw is a lecturer in the Department of Library and Information Science at Bulawayo's National University of Science and Technology. He has a PhD from the University of London on Gunwoodzo Marichera and was course tutor in the University of London School of Advanced Study before returning to Zimbabwe in 2009. He initially worked at Midland State University before moving to NASS. Drew has written extensively about Zimbabwean literature, recently giving a paper on the literature of the GNU in Oxford, which he is going to repeat here tomorrow evening. If anyone would like to come, they'd be more than welcome. So I'll now leave you to Drew Shaw and Noel Violet.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you very much, Noel Violet, for coming to Bulawayo to this book launch, where we're very happy to see you and to congratulate you once again on your extraordinary literary achievements.
Thank you for having me.
Very, very proud to have you here in Bulawayo. You've lived abroad for... Is it 13 years now?
Yes, yeah, about 13 years.
I was wondering if you can say what it feels like to have been away for that length of time and what it feels like now to return to Zimbabwe, to Bulawayo specifically.
I think part of the pain of diaspora is not being able to return home as one pleases. But I'm glad that after so long a time, I'm able to. And the interesting thing is, when I came back, I was in search of the Zimbabwe I left in 99. And of course, after more than a decade, things had changed dramatically. So when I came here in April, it was very rough. You know, I couldn't recognize the new space. I had to sort of adjust and sort of deal with new dynamics on the ground. That said, home is always home. You know, it's where I come from. My people are here. The city means a lot to me. The country means a lot to me. And it's just wonderful to be back.
Great. Your short story, Hitting Budapest, won you the Kane Prize. And it's also the first chapter of your novel, We Need New Names. I was wondering if you can tell us how the project evolved. Did the novel evolve from the short story, or how did it happen?
Actually, the world saw the short story first, understandably, you know, on the Kane Prize shortlist. But what happened is that this short story found me already working on the novel. So it definitely did not come first. It was part of a long process that dragged out over a few years. Yeah, but that said, it was a special moment. It was a turning moment because my protagonist, Darling, and her friends sort of came out of the margins with so much life and energy that I sort of switched the project and changed it to accommodate them, and they essentially took over, which I think is part of the creative purpose. You start off going one way, and then the book takes a life of its own. So that's how it happened.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a remarkable story and it's a remarkable novel. We Need New Names is, as Jill was saying earlier, a great read, and I would encourage everyone here to buy the book and read it, because it's really very entertaining, as well as covering so many poignant issues. Your narrator is a young girl who already said something about, whose name is Darling, and she tells quite an incredible story. I was wondering if you can briefly tell us what the story is about and what you're wanting to achieve in the novel as a whole.
This story is about a 10-year-old girl, Darling, growing up at a time when her country is falling apart due to political mismanagement that translates to a lot of difficult issues on the ground. So her life is really one of struggle, until she's lucky enough to leave Zimbabwe for the U.S. in pursuit of the American dream. But she gets to America and finds that life is not altogether as rosy as it's sold out to be. So the book ends with her sort of in this space of ambivalence, disconnected from her people, having lost a sense of identity and not quite fitting into America. And it's a project, as I've already hinted, that was inspired by Our Lost Decade. And it came from many, many things, including the desire to just bear witness, to put faces to a story that we were seeing on the media. Yeah.
Thank you. My next question relates to the title of your novel and to your name. Your novel's title is We Need New Names, and of course you've assumed a new name yourself. So I was wondering if you can tell us why you chose the nom de plume of Violet Bulawayo in particular.
Violet is my mother's name, and I wanted to sort of celebrate and honor her memory. And Bulawayo is the city of my people. Having lived outside for 10 years, not being able to go home, I was very nostalgic for the homeland, and it was my way of connecting with the place that I come from. And then the title comes from this push, this belief at the time I was writing that as a people, as a country, we needed new ways of seeing ourselves, new ways of imagining our realities, our destinies. And even across Zimbabwe, I felt like the society that I was engaging in needed a new way of looking at itself and looking at the various immigrants that came.
You certainly strike chords, I think, with a great many people, and the novel, although it grows out of Zimbabwe, I think has quite a universal appeal, and I think that's one of the reasons it's been shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. And you've answered the other question that I was going to ask, which is the Bulawayo part of your name, which I was going to ask if you felt a special connection with the city of Bulawayo.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's great to hear. My next question is about autobiography versus fiction. Your main character and your narrator, Darling, tells, as you said, about her childhood and early adolescence, leaving a shanty town, which is called Paradise, which is not paradise at all, actually, to live with her aunt Faustalina in Michigan, the United States of America, which is seen as the land of plenty, but that is somewhat kind of criticized, I think, in your novel as well. I'm wondering if there are any parallels with your I'm sure this question comes up a lot, with your own life, your own movement from Zimbabwe to America. To what extent do you identify with your narrator, Darling, and to what extent is the book maybe a little bit autobiographical as well as fictional?
I get that question quite a lot, and there are people actually wanting to say I'm Darling, which is obviously not the case. To begin with, Darling and I have two very different Zimbabwes. I was born right after independence. My generation, obviously, is called the Born Free Generation. And I remember my childhood being far from Darling's childhood, in the sense that things were working. You know, we lived pretty normal lives, whereas Darling is sort of, and her friends are sort of growing up in a country that's coming undone. So there, of course, we are very, very different children. That said, it was difficult to write about a 10-year-old without having to think about what children sound like. And I found myself going back to my own childhood, to the games we played, to the kinds of friends that I had. And that sort of helped me build my characters. When she goes to the U.S., there are some parallels, not quite, it's not, they are not very, very close. It's not an autobiographical, but she still borrows from me because I sort of understand what it's like to be an immigrant, to be an outsider, to struggle and juggle two different cultures. And I'm one of those writers who feels like whatever I'm working on needs to get its soul from somewhere, and it's from personal lived experience. Part of my one of the humbling factors about writing this book is hearing from people who connect to Dani, and they are not necessarily Zimbabwean or African. People from European descent, people from, I just recently got a note from somebody in India who identify with the story of leaving one's country and going to live, to exist in another. Yeah.
I think you're right, it strikes a chord universally. Darling is a character that many people in this world of globalization and mass migration can relate to. You talked, your reading, the second reading, the wonderful, funny reading about Aunt Faustina having difficulty with language is quite poignant. And language is an issue that comes up quite a lot in We Need New Names. I was wondering if you could talk more about that specifically. I know you've written a few pieces in Zilibele, which I believe is your first language, but that most of your work has been published in English. So my question is, which language do you prefer writing in? And can you talk about the pros and cons of writing in Zilibele versus the pros and cons of writing in English?
That's a difficult question that young writers need to be dealing with. Which language and why? I write in English, obviously, but it's not English with a capital E. It's English with a lowercase e, because I feel like it's English that captures my own language. It's English that relies on my Ndebele in order to be. And I got there just by embracing that my language, it's not the better when you see it, but its influence, it's almost necessary to capture the specific cultural experience of the space that I'm working on. It's very, very important. When my characters speak, they're speaking in the better. So I have to sort of arrive on the page through some sort of transcription, so to speak. And we're discussing this or evasion of this in workshop, that it's about ownership. It's about taking that English language and bending it, right, so that it suits us, so that it suits the kind of specific stories we tell. And I feel like that's a beautiful thing, actually. It travels the language, the English with an E. I think it opens doors for new voices, new ways of saying. Ndebele, I love my Ndebele language, which is part of why I'm trying to write. I have a story published here in Zim in an anthology by the amazing Barbara Makalisa. And it was sort of challenging writing it because I hadn't done it in a while. But then I realized that it's still the language of my dreaming. I speak it every day. And once I got myself in that zone, I was able to. And we are, I'm working at a time when the number of young people writing in native languages, not just the village, is dwindling. And I think that sort of paints a big future in terms of our language, because somebody has to keep them going. I'm not saying there are no efforts. I think there are people who are creative, but it's not enough. And one who calls Mbuki Wathiongo, who insists on writing his work in Kikuyu and then translating it to English. I think that's one brave fight. And I'd like to see more young people sort of at least writing in both languages. You're writing in English is fine, but try and still produce in Ndebele or Shona or whatever language. It's still important.
It's very interesting. Yeah. I find you're dealing with issues of language in this book very interesting and relevant. And you also managed to, as you said, as you implied, the type of language that the new generation use, textbook.
Oh, yeah.
Texting, Facebook language.
Oh, yes.
I come across all the time as I lecture at the university.
I
just
know.
Put a red line through it half the time. But
yeah,
to see it appear in your novels is quite amazing.
It's showing up in university.
All the time, yes.
Oh, Jesus.
So.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because I have nieces in the States who are 13, 14, and sometimes it doesn't strike you that you're old until they start writing things you have to Google online to understand what they're saying on Facebook with their friends. So,
yes, well, yeah. Thanks, Roy, because it's been quite an education.
Oh, yeah.
As well. The next question I want to ask you is about names in your novel. Place name, people names, and place names particularly.
Yeah.
I'll just... There's some interesting people names in your novel, and this is what you have to look forward to if you get the novel and read it. Bastard, God knows, forgiveness, darling, mother love, mother of bones, prophet, revelations, Bitchington, and Charlotte, for example. So it's very entertaining, this novel. It's poignant and sad in parts, but it's also very entertaining. Then we have place names like Paradise, which is actually a slum and anything but paradise, and Heavenway, which is also a very ironic name, and Budapest, which is a rich suburb where the children steal guavas. Then you have Chimaranga and Zilakansi streets. And I found myself trying to guess exactly where these places might be if they're inspired by real places. And I wondered if you could tell us to what extent the actual city of Boer and places in Boer are mapped into the novel.
It's fiction, Drew, it's fiction. Places are fictional. I'm interested in names and meaning of names and identity. And I think part of it is that I come from a culture where our parents think carefully about names they give us. Colorful names. I was at the Harare launch, I met a guy named Extra Blessing. We have a blessing in my family. My nephew is Blessing. And I have a friend named Mo Blessing. But that was the first time I saw Extra Blessing. And I was understandably happy to encounter Extra Blessing. I wish I thought of the name. But I wanted to bring that in my work. You know, I feel like, yeah, we have interesting things like that. So why not bring them in? And it's really as simple as that. I don't get those fine kind of questions from people who come from the background. But of course, when it's outside, the rest of, you know, some parts of the world think they are sort of the center, that everybody has to be called Adam and John and so on, and that's it. But then, yeah, some of us come from this imaginative and awesome backgrounds. And then places I was really interested in again, what is and what is not. Paradise, obviously, is supposed to be, you know, when you think of paradise, you are thinking in terms of a place of plenty where everybody's happy. But then the irony is that paradise here is a place where things are under pressure. And Budapest and all these other names, I feel like when people leave the country and come back, they are bringing something, not necessarily tangible things, but they are bringing other places back home. And I wanted to capture that dynamic as well. But I must say I had fun with the names. Yeah.
You certainly seem like you had fun with the names. They're great. Fantastic names. Now I want to talk about some more serious issues in the novel, in particular the plight of young girls and women who grow up in very poor environments. So your writing is actually done this beforehand, was short story snapshots. I can remember actually there was a book launch for Where To Now, the short story collection by Hammer Books, where that was read out a couple of years ago, and it was drawn also by an artist, Aseka, at the same time. And it highlights the plight of a young woman who's thrown out of her home, and then she is sexually exploited, and she ends up being the sad victim of a backstreet abortion. Then the theme sort of continues in We Need New Names, because you have an 11-year-old girl, Chipo, who carries the burden of a pregnancy from an incestuous rape, and also another issue that comes up later on with this rather horrifying scene of a female circumcision. So I was just wondering, on a more serious note, how you feel as a writer. Do you feel obliged in any way to expose social injustices, particularly those suffered by African girls and women?
Absolutely, I feel obliged. I am a woman myself, and only personally I'm very sensitive to the issues, to the plight of women who come from the backgrounds that I'm dealing with. Because the world, I mean, the reality is that the world is a very hostile place for women and girls, and its effects. And I am interested in issues of social justice, in things that we need to worry about as a culture, as a country, as citizens of the world. And art and literature is one way of keeping the dialogue going, you know, in terms of things like this, because they do happen. And then also realizing that some of these things are not things that people talk about. So for me, it becomes a form of unsilence, of speaking out. And I'm not the first one. Writers, both male and female, have done that before me. And I'm simply being part of a tradition of writers who also happen to be activists while they're editing. I just don't want to write and call it a day. I want to do more with my work.
And that comes through quite strongly in your writing. I think that's what people find quite appealing about it. Next question I have is about your narrative styles and strategies, sort of, which is to say that your narrator, darling, as you said, is a 10-year-old girl. But there's also a collective voice that comes through in the novel. But mostly the story is told by the 10-year-old girl, darling. So I wondered if you could tell us what the pros and cons, again, are of writing a whole novel, almost a whole novel, from the point of view of a child, using a child narrator. In other words, did you find that there were any limitations? Did you sometimes feel like, oh, I really would have liked to have used an adult's voice in this particular situation? I wondered if you could talk about that experience.
I mean, given that I was writing from a politically charged space, using a child narrator sort of gave me the distance to step away from the hard stuff and sort of work from something flexible, you know, because children are interested in, they're not interested in the big picture, the big charged picture. They're interested in what games they are playing, stealing guavas, which of course will speak to the political picture, but not in engaged ways. So I was able to play on the naive, on their being naive and on their innocence to still tell a story. And they also offered the option of humor that I was struggling with an adult narrator. I think children are generally funny. They can be funny and, you know, entertaining to work with. So for me, that was an attraction. And obviously, thinking in terms of how
we don't, as a people, get up and ask children what they think about the world, because they are children. They don't count in that way, in the sense that they don't run things, and we never get to hear their opinion. So for me, the challenge became trying to find out how 10-year-olds would process this this space that inspired the novel. In terms of the disadvantages, I like taking challenges and working with them. And I think the disadvantages were not that many, frankly. Yeah.
Well, it's a riveting read. The child's voice is very captivating, as I've seen before, and takes us through an extraordinary sequence of events where we witness all sorts of things, and to see them through the eyes of the child is really very interesting. Next question is about your literary mentors, if you have any. I wondered if you could talk about favorite writers or writers who have influenced you in the past or in the present. Literary mentors.
When I think of my mentors, I think firstly to the storytellers of my childhood, people who told me stories. I think when we talk of African literature, it's worth remembering that it's not all written. And so for me, it started with storytellers, and I think that's where I developed an ear for language, for how a story is told, for pacing. And obviously, as I grew older and got an interest, started to develop an interest in books, I discovered writers like Yvonne Vera, who meant so much to me in terms of her bravery, the type of stories she told, then her unique, very amazing voice, amazing but complex voice. Writers like Toni Morrison, Moving Abroad, Juno Diaz, Koluma Ken, Edward P. Jones. You know, those are some of the writers that I always return to. But I'm also pleased that I'm writing at a time again of younger writers that were not there when I was growing up. And in Bulawayo here, we have people like Novio Chuma. There's Chris Mlalazi, and then there's Bettina Kapa, who's based, I think she's based in Switzerland right now. Yeah, so there's all this inspiration everywhere. And of course, real life too. Real people on the ground, because it's not all about books. You don't get stories, you know, in books.
It's true, and it's great to see such a good showing of writers here at the launch. There are a number of Bulawayo writers here, and those dialogues between writers are very fruitful always, I think. So we're privileged to have all the writers in our midst. I was going to, on that subject, I know there are also some aspiring creative writers here. And you've just had a workshop this morning, the whole day actually. So Navayat's had a very busy day, by the way. I think she got here from Harare at 8 in the morning, and she's been doing the workshop all day, so she's done very well so far. But I wondered if you could talk a little bit more now about how you write, the process, because this is what other writers find quite interesting. Is it regular? What time of the day do you start? How long do you write for? How many drafts do you go through before you get to a finished product? How does it all happen? Can you tell us something about that?
My process was challenged in workshop today because I tend to be a solitary writer. Just turn off my cell phone, I live by myself, and I just disconnect from the world and write. And one amazing, you know, contributor and workshop say, "Now you miss things, you miss out on things." But I wait for the story to sort of come. And We Need New Names was that kind of story where I could not do anything else. And lucky enough, I had the time and the circumstances to just wake up at 5:30 in the morning, go to bed at 9. I was taking classes of teaching in between, But for me, that's how I do it. Just dedicate myself to the project. And when I'm not writing, I'm looking for stories everywhere, either on the ground or online. That's how we're connected. That's how I stay in touch with people. Or read, because reading is still a big part of writing. Yeah. But we're all, and on that note, you know, the reading situation on the ground, yes, it's worrisome. And I said, I remember going to Kingston Books, where I used to go in Marvel and novels when I was young. And I was told that they don't sell books, they sell stationery. So I think that speaks to the reading culture on the ground, that more people are not reading books. And it's something that, that I think is cause for concern, because I feel like a healthy society is one that we, especially if we want young writers to keep writing, or if we want to be aware of what people are writing, the issues around us, the state of our world. So I hope that's something that that improves.
I think a lot of people would agree with you wholeheartedly on that issue. We're still on the subject of creative writing. This is my last question. You've done a master's degree at Cornell in fine art, including creative writing.
Yes.
Is that correct? Do you think that creative writing can be taught? That's the first part of the question. And what else does it have to be an inborn talent? And assuming that it can be taught, can you please give us some award-winning tips in case any of us would like to get shortlisted for the Kane Prize or the Guardian Prize or the Man Booker Prize?
I already gave them during workshop. But I feel it's both. I feel sometimes talent comes in the form of a writer, but talent alone is not enough. I think you need hard work to complement that talent. I think it needs learning about craft, learning how to write a story, how to structure that scene, how to write dialogue and other literary elements. So it goes both ways. And again, reading is part of the mix. And you will find amazing teachers in other writers. You know, we're talking today about finding mentors, because we won't teach all the creative writing students all they know about creative writing. They need to go out there. And today I feel like people are lucky, because again, we have social networks where you can upload your stuff on websites like Zotro and get critiqued by somebody who maybe has studied for creative writing. So it's able to actually have those kinds of exchanges with people. Yeah.
That's fantastic. I think that the tradition of writing in Zimbabwe can only grow from strength to strength. But as you say, it would be nice for the tradition of, or the habit of reading to keep pace with that as well, because as you've said, I think that's also important. Thank you very much for sharing all of those insights and talking about your novel and your writing. I think I speak for everyone here in saying how appreciative we are of you coming here to talk to us, and also in wishing you very good luck for the Man Booker Prize and the Guardian First Book Prize and all the prizes that you've been nominated for.